Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Federal Reserve right after this. You know, in Job 38, verse 24, we read a scientific question. It says, "By what way is it that the light is parted?" Or if we paraphrased it, it would say, "By what way or technique is the light apportioned or separated?" Now, could you imagine asking a question like that 4,000 years ago? Today, of course, it's a simple question to ask and answer, and a student instantly answers by passing it through the prism of the spectroscope. But who could have known that 4,000 years ago back in Job's day? Now, when we heat a metal red hot or we heat any substance until it's incandescent, it gives forth rays of light. These rays of light, after passing through the prism of the spectroscope, divide themselves on a graph according to the content of the matter that sent them forth. So when a ray of light reaches us from some far-flung star, all we have to do is pass that light ray through a spectroscope to see the composition of the star. And this division of light rays is always constant. It doesn't vary in the least particular. So we can always rely upon those results. Spectroscopic analysis, then, is an exact science, and this is the manner by which the light is apportioned. So that places us in a quandary. Because either Job knew that, or else supernatural wisdom is being revealed here. And that's just one more of the many examples of science in the Scripture. And it's one more of the many lessons in my Mosaic Law School that I teach here in Isabella, Missouri. If you'd like more information, why don't you call and order my free General Law CD package. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. Now, it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free, and you can call and order yours right now. The number is 417-273-4967. If you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send us an email request for that free General Law CD package. Again, georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Well, most people have heard something about the Federal Reserve and about fiat currency and fiat money, but probably the world's number one authority on fiat currency, especially the Federal Reserve, is Edwin Vieira, Jr. Edwin Vieira has written extensively. He's an attorney, lives in Washington, D.C., or the environs thereof, and heads an organization which is called the National Alliance for Constitutional Money. He's argued cases before the Supreme Court. He's very familiar with Article 1, Section 10 of our Constitution, very well versed in gold and silver coin and gold and silver money, hard money, soft money, fiat money. And he makes some very interesting observations. He said, "Most contemporary debate on the Federal Reserve System focuses on whether what people call the dollar should in some way be linked to or backed by gold or another valuable commodity. The fundamental unexamined and totally fallacious assumption in this debate is that the paper currency the Federal Reserve System generates, the Federal Reserve note, is as a matter of fact and a matter of law a dollar at all. As American constitutional law and American constitutional history plainly show, the Federal Reserve note is not a dollar. It never has been declared by Congress to be a dollar, and could never be an actual dollar, notwithstanding all of the statutes or resolutions that Congress might enact. Rather, as cited in the Constitution and as historically defined in the Coinage Act of 1792, a dollar is a specific coin and it contains 371.25 grains of fine silver. When it's put very finely, the Constitution fixes the monetary unit of the United States as this silver dollar. It empowers Congress to coin silver and gold coins and to declare the values of which are to be regulated in relation to that dollar, and prohibits any government from issuing what the Founding Fathers denominated bills of credit and what we today would understand as paper currency, redeemable in silver or gold, and it outlaws any form of legal tender except silver and gold coins. So, from the constitutional perspective, it is literally senseless to talk about making the dollar redeemable or adopting a silver or gold-backed dollar, and that such debate as occurs on the Federal Reserve System and the Federal Reserve note fixes on this senseless point, and it demonstrates how confused the American people are concerning their own monetary system. So let's take a look at defining the dollar. Defining a dollar constitutionally, however, is only the first step in explaining the real problem that the Federal Reserve System poses. Three other matters require careful consideration. First of all, the evolution of the Federal Reserve System exemplifies the typical historical devolution or corruption of monetary systems throughout the world in the last two centuries, from commodity money to fiduciary money, and then finally to fiat money. Here, accurate definitions of various forms of money will be very useful to us. First of all, a commodity money is a medium of exchange, the units of which are fixed amounts of an actual commodity that has value other than as money alone. Historically, silver and gold coins of known standard weights and designs have emerged as the preferred commodity monies of the entire civilized world. In the case of a commodity money, the actual commodity, that is the silver or gold, is both the medium of exchange and it is also the standard of value, that is, the unit in which prices are stated in the marketplace. The supply of commodity money is self-limited by the costs of mining, refining, and coinage of the silver and gold coins. New supplies of commodity money will be coined only to the extent that coinage is economically profitable in comparison to alternative investments of the capital needed to mine these precious metals. This takes us then to fiduciary money. A fiduciary money is a medium of exchange composed of some intrinsically valueless substance, such as paper, which the issuer promises to redeem on demand in a commodity money, such as silver or gold coin, or in a monetary commodity such as silver or gold bullion. Historically, private bank notes and government treasury notes were fiduciary monies in general circulation prior to the 1930s. In the case of a fiduciary money, the paper promised to pay is the medium of the day-to-day exchange. But the actual money and the ultimate standard of value remains the promised medium of payment, the silver or gold coin with which the note is to be redeemed. The supply of a fiduciary money is also self-limited by the requirement of redemption. In a real free market system, new supplies of a fiduciary money will be issued only to the extent that the issuer is confident that he can satisfy demands for redemption of its notes in a commodity money. The condition in a free market system is critical because the self-limiting aspect of fiduciary money historically has failed in an economic regime in which the government or powerful private interests license the issuers of the fiduciary monies to suspend or to repudiate entirely their promises to redeem those monies on demand in coin. And then finally, we come to fiat money. A fiat money is a medium of exchange composed of some intrinsically valueless substance which the issuer does not promise to redeem in any commodity or any fiduciary money. Because a fiat money has no direct legal connection to a commodity money in terms of redemption, and therefore no real economic cost to its production, the supply of a fiat money can never be self-limiting, and the value of the fiat money is always largely a matter of public confidence in the economic or political stability of the issuer. It is for these reasons, historically, that every major fiat money has self-destructed in what is popularly called hyperinflation. That is, extreme decreases in purchasing power caused by either unlimited increases in the supply of that fiat money by the issuer, or accelerating loss of public confidence in the continued value of that money or the economic or political fortunes of its issuer, or a combination of the two. Here then are the three forms of money: commodity money, gold and silver; fiduciary money, that is paper backed by gold or silver; and then finally a fiat money, such as our current Federal Reserve note system. Now, the theory and history of fiduciary money, which is also largely the theory and history of banking, must always focus on the ever-present problem of redemption. Emphasis on the noun problem is warranted because a fiduciary money is, by definition, a promise to pay the real commodity money of the country. A piece of commodity money, typically a silver or gold coin, is itself payment because it contains a fixed weight of precious metal. But a unit of fiduciary money, typically a bank or government treasury note, is only a contingent and uncertain payment that depends upon the ability or it depends upon the willingness of the issuer to redeem. And there always exists a temptation for issuers to renege on their promises to redeem. Thus, fiduciary money always threatens to become fraudulent money. Not surprisingly, therefore, the history of fiduciary money has been more or less the history of monetary fraud, both economic and political. Now, the danger of fraud in the issuance of fiduciary money becomes particularly acute in the case of modern fractional reserve banking. Under fractional reserve banking, the bank always issues more units of this fiduciary money, supposedly payable on demand, of course, than it has units of commodity money available for redemption, that is, money in the vault, counting on the unlikelihood that the majority of its customers will ever seek redemption at the same time. Thus, modern fractional reserve banking is inherently fraudulent because for the bank simultaneously to fulfill all of its promises to redeem its outstanding notes on demand is impossible. Second, the bank's managers know that complete redemption on demand is impossible and therefore that the bank's promises to pay are false. And third, the bank's customers, by and large, are ignorant of how the fractional reserve scheme works and the dangers that it poses to them. Now, to fully comprehend the significance of the Federal Reserve System also requires recognition that no such thing as politically neutral or politically independent money exists. And that's because, ultimately, money is a medium both for storing wealth and for exchanging wealth. So money is both itself a form of property and a mechanism for implementing contracts that transfer other kinds of property from one party or one person to another. So even in a free market economy with a limited government, money exhibits a necessarily political character. inasmuch as the degree to which the government protects the monetary system from private fraud and public looting reflects the degree to which the government respects and protects private property and the right of private contract. A free market economy will have one kind of money. A mixed or fascist economy will have a different kind of money, and then a socialist economy will have yet a third type of money, and so on. But in each case, the monetary system will accurately reflect the values of the political system. So once again, the contemporary debate over whether and to what degree the Federal Reserve System should be politically independent, independent of Congress and the United States Treasury, is badly misdirected. Originally, the Constitution made American and Americans' money independent of electoral politics by fixing the monetary unit as the silver dollar, outlawing bills of credit, and allowing only silver and gold coin to operate or circulate as legal tender in the payment of debts. But the Constitution is itself the basic political charter of the country. So, far from making money politically independent or politically neutral, the Constitution actually settled on one very specific political formula for money, namely a commodity money of historically proven intrinsic value, the supply of which the political authorities could not manipulate at will. Enter then the creation of the Federal Reserve System in 1913. And did not render Federal Reserve notes politically independent or politically neutral, but rather it changed the political character of the monetary system by empowering a small, unelected clique of self-professed experts and self-interested bankers and politicians to have complete control and supply of the Federal Reserve notes, interest rates, and other monetary and banking phenomena. Thus, as contrasted with the constitutional system, the Federal Reserve System actually politicized money by enabling politicians, administrators, and a few selected special interest groups to exercise the very influence over this country's monetary and banking systems that the Constitution had originally disallowed. Americans tend to accept the descriptions of the Federal Reserve System as politically independent because, although control of the monetary and banking systems has serious political significance, the apologists for the Federal Reserve System have been successful, and I might add, very successful over the years in removing monetary and banking issues from the agenda of political parties and from the agenda of political candidates, and then stifling public discussion on those very issues. So it is of vital political importance that no major political movement now advocates the system restoration or the immediate restoration of America's constitutional monetary system of silver and gold coinage. And it is of vital political importance that no major political movement demands that all of the paper currencies of the private banks be true fiduciary monies, that is, be redeemable in silver or gold or for some other commodity with intrinsic value. It is of vital political importance that no major political movement attack or attacks inherently fraudulent fractional reserve banking. And it is of vital political importance that no major political movement denounces the incestuous and corporate relationship between the national government and the banking industry through the Federal Reserve System, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, or any other federal agency. It is of vital political importance that no major political movement challenges the government's use of the monetary and banking systems to regulate the economy and to impose pervasive police state surveillance on every individual. It is of vital political significance that the short-run effects of the Federal Reserve System, monetary and banking policies, are very unclear to the average American, and that identifying in the long run who gains and who loses, what is gained and what is lost, and why all of this happens is also very difficult even for economists and political scientists. And it is of vital political significance that members of the Congress apparently lack incentives, or actually labor under disincentives, to investigate, let alone to correct, these misguided and harmful policies of the Federal Reserve System. And it is of vital political significance that the general public is simply unable to devise effective strategies for dealing with the Federal Reserve System as a supposed agency of the federal government. So obviously, a group that could completely excise these matters from political discourse in the United States without complaint by any significant part of the public must be a very powerful entity indeed. Now, how did the apologists for the Federal Reserve System and how they have been successful since 1913 in their concerted attacks and their stifling political debate on money and banking and the history books do not satisfactorily explain them. But what is very clear enough, nevertheless, is that the Federal Reserve System was established to remove the Constitution as the arbiter of national monetary policy. And they've done it on behalf of all Americans, and to guarantee instead that certain special interest groups are disproportionately, indeed monopolistically, represented in the determination of that policy for the particular benefit of those groups and everyone else's expense. So, here, more than one level of analysis is pertinent. At the first level, the Federal Reserve System appears as primarily a mechanism to stabilize the inherently fraudulent fractional reserve banking system. From this perspective, the purpose of the Federal Reserve System is not necessarily to do what the bankers want, but rather to do always what they need. Consider the devolution of the monetary system from a regime of commodity money to one of fiat money. Under a regime of commodity money, the bankers employ the inherently fraudulent fractional reserve system to expand the supply of fiduciary money, that is, banknotes and deposit currency, beyond the supply and demand money, that is gold and silver coin, available for redemption. So, in this regard, it has two effects. First, the bankers can loan more money than otherwise would be possible, thereby creating greater profits. And the holders of the fiduciary money become unknowing and presumably unwilling partners with the bankers in these excessive loans, thereby spreading the risk of those loans throughout society and indirectly ensuring that the bankers, at the expense of the general public, profit as well. Because the explanation of the supply of this inherently fraudulent fiduciary money is limited by the possibility of widespread demands for redemption, this is the so-called bank runs, followed by bankruptcy of the issuing banks, the bankers as a class support a series of steps designed to insulate the fractional reserve banking scheme and to prevent it from collapsing. So first of all, they use every available means of propaganda, agitation, and disinformation in order to instill unjustified confidence into the holders of fiduciary money. So, as to minimize redemption and thereby facilitate ever greater expansion of the supply of that money, underfunded deposit insurance schemes, either public or private, typify this deceptive tactic. And if bank runs do occur, the bankers then importune the government to authorize suspensions of specie payments. Temporary refusals on the part of the issuers of the fiduciary money to redeem their notes with commodity money. And this permits then the bankers to remain in business even though they're bankrupt. Suspensions of specie payments are a key indicator of the breakdown of the free market economy because they are a governmentally protected repudiation of contracts. In effect, it is a governmentally licensed theft. To prevent these bank runs altogether, the bankers lobby for governmental permission to repudiate their fiduciary money totally and permanently. That is, to transform their fiduciary money into fiat money. This generally requires that the government activate some mechanism for the forced circulation of this fiat money. Now, by making that money the unit for payment of taxes and for public expenditures, or by declaring that money legal tender for all debts, or by outlawing contracts payable in any form or any other form of money, especially commodity money. Now, these steps substitute the government, actually the taxpayers, for the banks and their shareholders as the ultimate guarantors of the fiat money, in return for which the banks agree to just two requirements. They monetize the public debt, thereby in effect enabling the government to use the fiat money system as an instrument of taxation. And two, they cooperate in a cartel or other self-regulatory scheme to control their expansion of the supply of fiat currency within those limits that maintain public confidence in, and in short, in the banking system and the government. Finally, the government and the banks agree to divide the amount that can be looted from the general public by manipulation of the money supply, and to moderate that looting so that the public never catches on to what's happening. The Federal Reserve System is simply an elaborate device set up to accomplish these rather simple ends in a highly convoluted and thereby deceptive way. The Federal Reserve System was the response of bankers and their political cronies to decades of failures in the fractional reserve banking system at the local and regional levels throughout the United States. So the Federal Reserve System was an attempt to maintain that system in perpetuity. First at the national level with the Federal Reserve Act in 1913, and then at the international level with the Bretton Woods Agreement in 1944. Was is the very appropriate verb because the Bretton Woods Agreement collapsed in 1971. It collapsed when President Nixon's repudiation of redemption of Federal Reserve notes in gold coin internationally and mounting strains in the system have been appearing domestically ever since the 1970s. Now, the key dates in the devolution of the Federal Reserve System are as follows. In 1913, Congress created the Federal Reserve System, and it permitted the emission of Federal Reserve notes redeemable in lawful money, and declared Federal Reserve notes to be obligations of the United States, but not legal tender. In practice, the Federal Reserve banks and the United States Treasury and their attempts to redeem Federal Reserve notes for gold coin on demand. The Federal Reserve notes are a fiduciary currency. Then in 1933, Congress repudiated the redemption of Federal Reserve notes in gold for United States citizens. And they went on to declare that Federal Reserve notes shall be legal tender. And the government continues to redeem Federal Reserve notes in gold for foreigners. And United States citizens can redeem Federal Reserve notes for lawful money, such as United States Treasury notes and silver certificates, which is redeemable in silver coins. Therefore, Federal Reserve notes remain a fiduciary currency redeemable directly in gold internationally and indirectly in silver domestically. Back in 1968, Congress repudiated the redemption of all forms of lawful money in silver, thus turning the Federal Reserve note into a fiat currency domestically for the very first time. And then in 1971, President Nixon repudiated the redemption of Federal Reserve notes in gold, thus turning Federal Reserve notes into a fiat currency internationally for the very first time. So today, Americans suffer under a regime of fiat money and unlimited fractional reserve banking. And in this system, the Federal Reserve System plays a very simple but vital role. When public confidence in the monetary and banking systems weaken, the Federal Reserve System acts to restore confidence. The Federal Reserve System may use what the public considers drastic means in this alleged fight, but never means so drastic that they precipitate genuine economic collapse or seriously endanger the long-term interests of the banking cartel, its satellite industries, or its political cronies. Hang on, I got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one for yourself. Please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. However, these endorsements or recommendations that we give out do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate. And that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not totally or is not usually totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers or our sponsors or the management or staff of this network or local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Tonight's review, the Federal Reserve System, a monograph number 4 put out by Edwin Vieira Jr. And he is the head of or represents the National Alliance for Constitutional Money, located at 13877 Napa Drive, Manassas, Virginia, 22111, and their phone is 703-791-6780. Continuing, he says that the unavoidable problem, of course, is that any system of fractional reserve banking suffers from the inherent instability that increases over time because at the base, fractional reserve banking is, in fact, a Ponzi or pyramid scheme. And it is for that reason that fractional reserve banking is a confidence game. It's a confidence game in both senses of that term. The Federal Reserve System, the banking cartel, and the politicians of the American one-party system operate on the theory that you can fool all of the people some of the time, and some of the people all of the time. And that's more than good enough. But they forget that, as Lincoln concluded, you can't fool all of the people all of the time. Over time, there are always some people, a small minority, often though composed of large numbers of these people who do learn, and people who have learned tend to act on their knowledge. So the remaining lifetime of the Federal Reserve System confidence game may, and likely will, be relatively short from this point on. On a higher level of analysis, the Federal Reserve System is not simply a control mechanism for the national banking cartel, but it is also one of the most important mechanisms in a pervasive system of fascist economic regulation that has been set up in this country, slowly but surely, since the turn of the century. This explains the political independence of the Federal Reserve System in a way more logical than the idea that money and banking are no longer politically important, divisive, or even interesting subjects. If a fascist state is to regulate the economy with relative autonomy from the electoral public and most special interest groups, then its monetary agency must claim political independence. Actually, in a fascist state, all of the regulatory agencies must claim political independence to some degree, which claim, not surprisingly, is advanced by essentially every administrative agency of the national governmental body today. But the degree of political independence will vary with the importance of the agency to the overall scheme of the centralized regulation of society. So, the political independence the Federal Reserve System claims is precisely expectable where it parts of an anti-democratic mechanism of economic and political control, and that no constitutional branch of national government, not the Congress, not the President, not the Supreme Court, disputes the Federal Reserve System's supposed independence and proves that those branches, too, have been co-opted as agencies of the Federal Reserve System's fascist welfare state. In sum, contemporary political money and politicized banking system that generates it have five major consequences. First of all, the first consequence. Modern political money is the prime means by which the government operates a scheme of oppressive hidden taxation through increases in the supply of money that generate systemic increases in the prices of goods and services. It is what the public calls in general inflation. Second, by operating as a system of hidden taxation, modern political money licenses the dominant financial and political oligarchy of this country to redistribute the nation's wealth from one group to another. More than $6 trillion has been redistributed since World War II, according to the American Institute for Economic Research. Third, by functioning as a mechanism for redistribution of the wealth, modern political money systematically corrupts the electoral process. It enables politicians to buy votes with promises of new or expanded governmental spending programs made possible only by the banking system's ability to monetize the public debt. Fourth, by linking the banking system to the public debt, modern political money licenses the banks to loot the public treasury. Initially, they do this by guaranteeing Federal Reserve notes as obligations of the United States and specially privileging those notes as legal tender, and then ultimately by providing taxpayer-funded bailouts of the bankers when the scheme or schemes of inherently fraudulent fractional reserve banking collapses. Now, fifth and finally, modern political money and political banking function as key mechanisms in the scheme of fascist central economic planning. Now, that misdirects and wastes resources and thereby lowers the standard of living of the vast mass of Americans for the benefit of the privileged few. And although long a powerful and today still a politically untouchable institution, the Federal Reserve System faces a dismal future, and this can be assessed by considering the contemporary political economic considerations that have given rise to the problem of collapsing domestic banks. The first of these conditions is the essentially fictional and fraudulent nature of modern paper money and fractional reserve banking. The fictional and fraudulent character of contemporary paper money is a demerit additional to the inescapable economic disparity between all paper money and real money, that is, gold and silver coins. Paper money can never be economically equivalent to real money because a transfer of real money between two persons immediately transfers a real asset, that is, the silver or gold that comprises the coins. Now, unlike real money, which is itself the monetary substance, paper money is merely a promise to pay real money at some future date, subject, of course, to various contingencies, and all of these contingencies are totally uncertain. It is for that reason that a transfer of paper money between two persons does not and cannot transfer the underlying monetary asset immediately. Only the promise to pay, that is, the liability of the maker of the promise, is transferred. And that's why you cannot pay a debt at law with paper money. And inasmuch as the promise may be more or less secure due to the creditworthiness or credit unworthiness of its maker, a transfer of paper money transfers not only a claim to the underlying real monetary asset, but also a risk of loss should the promise of payment, that is, the redemption, not be honored in whole or in part. In short, even when paper money is actually a promise to pay, and potentially fully redeemable in silver or gold coin. It still remains an asset to its holder only to the extent that the issuer of the promise ultimately makes good on his liability to redeem, or that other people or themselves or are themselves sufficiently confident of the promisor's solvency to accept the paper money at its face value in exchange for non-monetary goods and services. So in the final analysis, paper money is an asset only if it can be cashed or passed without loss in purchasing power as against real money, which the holder of paper money can determine only when he actually cashes or passes the paper money on. In the United States, for example, today's fiat paper currency is neither itself a valuable commodity nor even a credible promise to pay a valuable commodity in redemption. No holder of a Federal Reserve note has any legal right to require that the Federal Reserve Banks or the United States Treasury redeem those notes for any amount of any commodity. And no holder of those notes has any legal right to compel any other ordinary person to exchange a fixed amount of any goods or services for some known nominal value of this currency proportional to some weight of silver or gold coin. Indeed, notwithstanding the statutory mumbo-jumbo which mandates their redemption in lawful money, guaranteeing them as obligations of the United States and declaring them legal tender for all debts, the most that any holder of a Federal Reserve note can demand as a matter of law is that the national government receive them in discharge of tax liability. So, for that reason, the Federal Reserve notes are largely fictional money, for they are, in fact, and in law, a medium of exchange, certain exchanges of which are absolutely refused by their issuers, and consequently refused by everyone else in the marketplace, and which the government accepts only to set off antecedent tax claims, the size of which it unilaterally determines in the first instance. Federal Reserve notes are really just tax anticipation coupons masquerading as money. Now, similarly, contemporary reserve banking is not merely fractional, but rather inherently fictional, because no bank in the Federal Reserve system maintains any real reserves of money, only paper notes or bookkeeping entries, what the system can create out of nothing, and at any moment and in any amount, but the purchasing power of which in real money, silver or gold or in any other valuable commodity, the system cannot guarantee at any time or to any degree. Now, moreover, an essentially fictional, or the essentially fictional character of contemporary fiat paper currency and reserve banking, is the source of their inherent fraudulence. Because the fiction is unknown to, indeed carefully hidden from, the general public, the special privilege of the Federal Reserve System to emit unlimited amounts of irredeemable, legal tender, paper currency, and to loan that currency at interest through the system's commercial member banks amounts to a veritable license to steal, because the general public is totally unaware of the economic significance of the currency's irredeemability, and ignorantly assumes, then, that its designation as legal tender compels its use as a medium of exchange to the exclusion of all other forms of money. The abjectly fictional nature of modern paper currency and fractional reserve banking actually encourages the question, why do fiat FRNs continue to circulate? And why do banks without any real monetary reserves continue to inflate? Those who accept the theory that money is whatever the government decrees would answer that Federal Reserve notes or bank deposits denominated in Federal Reserve notes have value as media of exchange in the marketplace because people must acquire them in order to pay their taxes. Well, the obvious fallacy here, though, is that the government accepts payment of taxes in Federal Reserve notes precisely because those notes have a finite purchasing power in the marketplace and therefore are usable as money. Now, by the government, used as money by the government, it is not the present and future taxability of the notes that gives them their market exchange value. But rather it is their residual market exchange value that renders them viable as a medium of taxation. So one must recall that FRNs were originally redeemable, directly or indirectly, in gold coins, silver coins, or both. And it's for that reason that Federal Reserve notes had a real exchange value in the marketplace that reflected their underlying redemption values in gold or silver coin, and depended not at all on their use as a medium of taxation, but indeed made them valuable for that purpose. When Federal Reserve notes became wholly irredeemable after 1971, they lost any fixed or predictable market exchange value in terms of real money, and therefore they became of increasingly uncertain value as a medium of taxation also. And, at least to the extent that they continue to depreciate in market exchange value as they have steadily done since then. Now, a more realistic explanation for the continued circulation of Federal Reserve notes or bank deposits denominated in Federal Reserve notes and called money is that the general public is the victim of a confidence game in which the government and the banks have foisted off paper liabilities in the place of real monetary assets in an inverted pyramid of monetary fraud. At the tip of this upside-down pyramid are real dollars, silver and gold coins that are themselves monetary assets and no one's liabilities, and they circulate among those knowledgeable about the differences between real money and paper money. 5% of all of the people in the United States control 100% of all of the gold and silver. 95% of the population of the United States has virtually no gold and no silver. Next in amount in circulation and at the first level of the institutionalized fraud are the base metallic token or clad coins of cupro-nickel alloy. These are monetary assets to the extent of their salvageable metallic content, which is worth about 2% or less of their face value. But otherwise, these are liabilities of the government which at one time were redeemable in silver, but are today wholly irredeemable. Now, the next largest fraudulent circulating medium consists of actual Federal Reserve notes today, redeemable only in clad coins, and finally, the greatest portion of the so-called money supply consists of bank demand deposits, most of which have been loaned at interest to persons other than the depositors. Revealing not only are these purported deposits not actually on deposit in the banks at all, but also the deposits are not even formally redeemable because the deposits themselves are not of the depositor's money, but rather it is the bank's money. And the deposits are loans of money, and depositors, many of them totally ignorant and unknowingly, have made to the banks, and which the banks have then further loaned to third parties. But how many people are aware of this situation in America today? And why do the government and the banks not educate those who are unaware of what is really going on? Other than because the government and the banks knowingly profit from public ignorance and thereby and therefore intentionally promote. And how long can such a swindle continue? Now, this question highlights the second of the contemporary political economic conditions that underlie the problem of collapsing domestic banks, namely, the inability of the banks to continue indefinitely to increase the supply of this fiat money within the domestic economy. That is, as the saying goes, to expand credit. Because the supply of this new money derives from the extension of bank credit to borrowers. The answer to the question, how long can this confidence game last, is not forever, but we don't know how long. If on the one hand the banks overly expand credit, hyperinflation occurs, that is, the purchasing power of the monetary unit falls exponentially. If on the other hand the banks overly restrict the expansion of credit in order to avoid hyperinflation, recession and then depression occurs. And that is, people borrow less, and then existing borrowers in massive numbers default on their loans. The banker's trick and the banker's dilemma is to continue to expand credit within an expanding and therefore essentially non-inflationary economy. The insoluble problem inherent in credit expansion through fractional reserve banking, however, is that expansion of a fiat money supply inevitably misdirects and then wastes real economic resources, resulting in an increasingly non-rational economy. That is, an economy that does not expand in real terms. In short, credit expansion by fractional reserve banking in the long run guarantees economic collapse, with resultant social chaos and political crisis. No crystal ball is necessary to predict that a turning point in the history of money and banking in the United States is rapidly drawing nigh. The burden of governmental debt, much of it made possible only by central bank monetization, has approached levels that are totally unsustainable in real terms, even with drastically increased confiscation of Americans' earnings through explicit taxation. But Americans seem reluctant to accept more taxation to fund the never-ending follies of a spendthrift welfare state. Thus, repudiation of the debt in whole or in part through extreme depreciation of Federal Reserve notes and bank deposits denominated therein appears likely. And in fact, it is a certainty. All right, we're going to have to leave it there. This is from the National Alliance for Constitutional Money. Remember the author, Edwin Vieira Jr. All right, you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. And for more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. Remember, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one for yourself. To order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Hey, our time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.